One of those things that people use to divide themselves into groups is math, as in good at math or not good at math. Today's guest might want to do away with those terms. Even if you can't tell the quadratic equation from a quart of milk, you could still have an aptitude for handling numbers. Barbara Oakley gives a wealth of ideas for overcoming math aversion in her book, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. Barbara Oakley is a professor of engineering at Oakland University near Detroit. As the book would indicate, she has a great interest in finding teaching methods that work, something she did at the school system in Pontiac, Michigan. She has written several other books and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, Jeffrey, it's a pleasure to be here.
So math appears to be in a category by itself. I mean, is this one of these things that people tend to think, oh, I'm not good at that?
Well, they do, and I think that's sometimes an error. For me, for sure, I grew up absolutely hating math and science. I thought I had absolutely no talent whatsoever. I flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science. And it was only when I reached age 26 and I was about to get out of the Army, I had enlisted to study a language, that I started looking at my job prospects and I began to realize that, you know, maybe math and science could really open some career doors for me. And I decided at that time to try and see if I could retrain my brain. And to my shock, it worked. Even though I had no talent whatsoever, there are actually some mental tricks and tools you can use that can help you in learning many new topics, not just math and science. And so I just kind of happened to stumble on them. And then as I matured in my research career, I began looking more carefully at them. And that's what the book came from.
Yeah, lest anybody think this is all just about plotting charts of X's and Y's and solving for Y, it's not that kind of a book. It's really much more about the process you can use. But it sounds like you made yourself sweat a fair amount in getting your own brain trained for math.
Well, yes and no, because one of the things that I learned was that people sometimes make the mistake of sitting down, for example, to solve a math problem, and they bang their head against a wall, and they can't solve it. And so they end up saying, hey, I'm not very good at this because I can't sit down and solve problems instantly and quickly. But it turns out that neuroscience has some insight into why that happens and what you can do to more effectively solve problems. And that insight is this. It turns out that you can simplify the brain's fundamental ways of operating into two really different modes of thinking. And I'll call one of them focused mode, and the other one is more sort of a diffuse way of thinking. It's that kind of semi-daydreaming or more relaxed kind of thinking. And you can actually see the very different physical patterns in the brain when you're in one mode as opposed to the other. Well, it turns out when you're focusing, that helps you solve problems that have just that you're pretty familiar with and you just have to take one tiny little extra step to solve it. But for problems that are more difficult, where you kind of have to step back and take a different approach, you need that more diffuse way of thinking to get you started with it. So often, the worst thing you can do when you're trying to solve a problem is to just keep bashing your head and focusing on it. The best thing to do is to focus as hard as you can, but then when you reach a stopping point, let it go, step away, and don't focus on it, because that will allow these other neural networks to start coming into play and helping you to solve the problem. So it's kind of surprising. Sometimes the best thing you can do to help yourself learn to solve these problems is to let go.
Not to grip it so tightly.
And then let go.
Yeah, not to grip it so tightly, in other words.
To do what?
Not to grip it so tightly, to let go, as you say, yeah.
Bingo, that's exactly right. Just let it go. And it works great, and that's why sometimes you'll step away from a problem, and then it will the solution will magically pop to mind later.
Barbara Oakley, you've done a lot of analysis of teaching. Is part of the problem here the way in which people are taught math? I could not get base five numbers with a tutor in grade five, but then the teacher in grade six said, here's what you do, and it was, oh, that's what it is.
Well, it depends. What I find surprising is that learning is so incredibly important that we spend something like 12 to 16 years of our lives in institutions of learning, but we're not really taught how our brain works. So that's what I think is so interesting.
All right, so now we are talking about how the brain works. We'll get more into focused mode and diffuse mode thinking when we come back and talk more with Barbara Oakley about her book, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. That's coming up with your comments and phone calls if you'd like to join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Barbara Oakley and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Barbara Oakley, PhD, a professor of engineering at Oakland University near Detroit. Professor of engineering, if you said that to her 30 years ago, she would have laughed really, really, really hard because she was pretty bad at math. Well, Barbara Oakley's book is called A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra, which is about what she did. Join us on the Exchange as we talk about the ways in which the brain works and the ways in which you can, in essence, use the brain's abilities and tuning to make it a lot easier to learn things like math and science. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Do you actually say in the book, Barbara, that our brain is designed for math?
Oh, it absolutely is. Every time you catch a ball or you twirl when dancing, you're actually doing computational analysis that's really complex. I mean, they have trouble getting robots to do those kinds of things, and the robots have to use mathematical algorithms. So, yes, we do all have natural gifts for not only language, but for math as well. And I think it's really fun to be able to tap into those gifts.
You write about math as this continuum where you have the lower levels of arithmetic, addition, subtraction, and then multiplication and division up through what you call the heavens of mathematical beauty. What's up there in the heavens?
Well, the higher you go, it can get even more beautiful. And I love calculus. I loved advanced probability. And for me, my specialty is electromagnetics, which is the most highly mathematical of all the electrical engineering disciplines, although I'm sure there are other specialists who would beg to differ with me. But there's something about kind of sliding through the ladders of Maxwell's equations from one equation to the next. That's actually, it's an exhilarating feeling. So I think What's important here, though, is to realize that when you're doing something like learning a language, you're actually using many of the same skills that you use when you're learning to do mathematics. And I think people often think that they're really very different realms, but we're actually using the same neural apparatus to pick up those kinds of ideas. So when you realize that, I think it actually helps make things a little bit easier.
Instead of thinking that, oh, no, I'm just not wired for that kind of thing, you really are.
You are. And not only that, different cultures, as it turns out, have different approaches to mathematics. And some cultures, I think, have a little bit smarter approach to mathematics than that which is commonly seen in the United States. And in these other cultures, what they do is they don't think of mathematics as this innate talent-driven sort of way of looking at the world. Instead, it's often looked at kind of like a skill. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's take driving. I mean, a lot of people can drive. And you may be a really good driver or you may be an okay driver, but most people learn how to drive. And so people don't approach driving with the idea that, you know, I'm just not good at it, so I'm just not going to be able to do it. No, you kind of learn how to drive because it's just a skill, and it may take you longer to learn to back up than somebody else, right? But you can still learn how to back up your car. Math is the same way. It's seen in the same way as some of these other cultures. It's just a skill. It may take you longer to pick up multiplication than somebody else, but once you pick it up, you've got it, and then you move on to the next skill that you acquire. So by thinking of math as something that's a skill rather than this something you can only learn if you've got the talent for it, you actually can do a lot better. And so I think that's something that's helpful for people to know.
That's a good sense of dividing up the way of looking at it. You know, you're taking it as, yes, your brain can do this, as opposed to, it's not like a soul thing, like I just don't have God in me or something, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And more than that, just, I think we're often told, and in all good conscience by people, to follow our passions. But one thing that people often don't realize is that passions come with what you're good at. And, I mean, it's easy to become passionate at something if you're good at that something. But some things take more time to get good at. And so sometimes we make initial decisions, as I did in my life, about what we're good at, and then I wrote off mathematics because I didn't feel I was good at it, right? And I wasn't. I was terrible at it. But I had never given myself the time or chance or opportunity to become good at it. And once I did that and was more patient with myself, then I was just kind of shocked. It's like, wait a minute, I think I'm beginning to like this. It was such a strange feeling. So I say, don't just follow your passions, broaden your passions, be willing to kind of push the envelope a little bit.
For yourself, Barbara, do you think you appreciate your career more than your career as a linguist because of the work you had to go through just to get to this point?
I think it's not only the work that I had to go through, but so many more doors opened for me once I acquired a technical and mathematical expertise. I was really surprised at that. And I think sometimes it's natural to think, well, gosh, a person who's trained as an engineer, for example, I can do almost all the same things that they can do, except they can also solve equations. But why can't I get the same job? Because I can do almost all of that, just not the equation part of it. But that's kind of like saying, well, I can do most of the same things that a surgeon can do, except, you know, maybe the cutting open part and things. I can't do that, but I can do most of the other things they do in their normal daily life. And in other words, there's a few critical little skills where it does make a difference if you have the ability to handle and to use those ideas. So I'm really glad that I worked to change my mindset and to grasp a new career, because I do feel like it opened not only whole new career paths, but it also kind of opened my mind to new ways of problem solving, even just in my everyday life.
Barbara Oakley is opening our minds to math and the possibilities of math and science with her book, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, our local number is 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jeannie in Medford, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good. Hi. God, I love math and science and physics. And, hey, I didn't fail algebra. I failed basic seventh grade mathematics. I never got to algebra till I met a great scientist lately in my later years. And I learned so much because it was so interesting. Now I'm very old, and I'm sort of a neighborhood tutor, and I make it fun. I find old math books. Look at the seashell. Look at a slug, a snail, the circles. Music is math. The seagull flying, that's, I know you don't want equations, Laplace's equations. And a wasp, the nest they bring the egg, that's an octagon. Aren't some of the sports domes built like that because of the strength, or hexagon, whatever it's called? Bubbles, I just realized, are mathematics. And flowers, and just, it's a wonderful topic. Thank you for talking about it. And I'm glad I have a simpleton seventh grade book that I found to help the kids here that are in ninth grade understand it.
All right. Thanks for sharing, Jeannie. Appreciate that. But that's the passion that you're looking for. You feel that same level of passion yourself, Barbara?
Oh, absolutely. I think Jeannie and I really share a lot in our approach to just the beauty of the world. I think that understanding a little bit more about the mathematics helps you appreciate the symmetry, the beautiful symmetry in nature and the underlying, unity of how things are held together in some sense by mathematics. So I think part of what Jeannie is doing that I love is she's focusing in and grabbing what makes sense to her and then really grabbing it so that she understands that aspect and building on it. And I think that's an important aspect for all of learning. I think sometimes people are intimidated. They say, oh, gosh, I'll never be able to learn algebra or calculus or whatever it is. But by breaking things down to a small, easily grasped chunk and then building another chunk on top of that and just working slowly with tiny bits, it's amazing what you can put together.
Part of the issue that I find is people don't see the applications in their own lives, particularly with young people in math. I still have a student in high school at home. And we were talking earlier about focused mode and diffuse mode thinking, and then diffuse mode thinking, you can see the big picture. But if a person who's learning a subject can't see the big picture, the old "I'll never use this in my life" thing, then are they even allowing diffuse mode thinking to take place?
I think they aren't, or they may not be, and let me come at it from the perspective that I came at as a young person. I mean, I was so vehemently antagonistic to mathematics that I ended up being called to the principal's office in seventh grade because I absolutely refused to pay attention. And I remember telling her, there is no way on earth you will ever make me pay attention because I know that mathematics is completely useless and that's that. And they never bothered me again. I just flunked my courses and went happily away. I think they realized that there was no reaching me. So I think for a person who has set it in their mind that they're not, math is worthless, that's just reasoning with them is not going to change that. What changed me was getting out into the real world and starting to see, wait a minute, you know what? The career opportunities are much more restricted for people who don't have a good ability to grapple with the many aspects of reality, which include mathematical, scientific, and technological aspects, at least in present day life. And it was bumping my head against the real world that finally opened my eyes to the fact that we may think that math is not relevant, but you know what? If you want a decent job, it can be very, very relevant. And it also gives you more flexibility. So I do think that it's important to, I mean, language and culture and the social sciences, they're important and they're fascinating and they're interesting. But life today is more encompassing than that. And it also includes things like technology, which include math and science. So it can be very valuable to acknowledge that and to broaden your horizons so that you're also taking in some of those kinds of ideas.
Let's take another call. Here's Ralph in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Barbara Oakley. Her book is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yes. thank you. I'll try to be succinct. I'm particularly concerned about what we call cognitive dissonance in our culture. It seems that the case that there are persons of strong moral values who are prepared to declare libertarian values, yet they want to intrude on a person's choices about contraception and abortion or privacy, and they are condemning to life children whose mothers feel unable by circumstances or temperament to not bear a child, yet we're not prepared to provide any support for those parents once those children are born. And I think probably there are many social ills in our culture that are a consequence of this phenomenon, like our incarceration rate, for example. And that whole notion of the relationship between mathematics and reasoning, like Pascal would have argued, is, I think, quite important, and I'll take your response on the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Ralph. So mathematics and general reasoning.
I think mathematics is extraordinarily important in general reasoning, and I think part of that grows out of the idea that, and this relates to engineering as well, there are real-world constraints. And there are real-world trade-offs. And I think that the more you understand sort of mathematical reasoning and how to rationally step by step from one logical point to another, but also realizing that there are trade-offs to everything you do, that can help you, even societally speaking, in making more intelligent decisions that benefit everybody. And I think that's part of what's difficult sometimes, though, is, and that's why I like engineering so much, is engineering has an appreciation for trade-offs, that it isn't just a rational step-by-step, but also everything you do, there's a good aspect to it, and there's a trade-off, you know, maybe not so good. I like, Mike Hammer was a business professor who did some marvelous studies on different businesses. And what he did, one thing he did was he analyzed many of the top companies through the world to see if there was a single aspect of these companies that they might have in common that he could point to and say that helped them to become some of the best companies in the world. And he finally found one common factor. And that one factor was that all of the CEOs of those companies had originally been trained as engineers. And so what this meant was that, at least in his analysis of the situation, was that these individuals had a very, very good understanding of trade-offs. For example, if you're running a car business or a car company, automotive manufacturing, you understand that you could make the most perfect, safe car in the world that nobody would ever crash and die in, But also, it would be so enormously expensive and difficult to move that nobody would ever want to buy it. So all of these aspects, I think, are very interesting in relation to learning.
Right. That's quite a set of trade-offs you talk about in engineering. We'll pursue that further when we come back. We'll talk more with Barbara Oakley about her book, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. A couple of phone calls waiting. You can join the queue, and we will take your phone calls and emails when we return from a break. Back with Barbara Oakley and you in a minute 20. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for joining us. Our guest is Dr. Barbara Oakley from Oakland University in Michigan. She has written a book called A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. She herself was terrible at math in school, became a linguist, and decided, you know, maybe there's something else I could do with my life, and then decided to tackle math. A lot of the things she learned about herself and about the human brain and how it works with math is contained in her book, A Mind for Numbers. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Barbara Oakley.
Thank you. Thank you for a fascinating discussion. When you talked, Dr. Oakley, about the computations that one does and dancing and turning and twirling, and then the woman called in about snails and seashells and bird flight and all of this, it reminded me of the origin of the word mathematics, which I've studied from studying ancient goddess religions. And the word mathematics comes from Ma and Themis. And Themis was the goddess, Greek goddess of wisdom, T-H-E-M-I-S, Ma Themis. So it was the wisdom, and Themis was the goddess of wisdom and understanding. And so it was the, mathematics comes from, literally means the wisdom of the mothers. And the other aspect that came into this too was the Hindu goddess Kali is known, and she's the creator and destroyer and preserver. She is known for the two basic fundamental aspects of measure and movement. And that all seems to relate to the all of creation and mathematics, which underlies it. And I thought that that was an interesting connection, that originally mathematics was deeply spiritual and came from a spiritual understanding of the cosmos.
Huh, that's great stuff. Well, it kind of gets back to the heavens of mathematical beauty that Barbara talks about in the book as well. Thanks for that, Vajra. And Barbara, this is not terribly surprising to you, I'm thinking.
Well, as Albert Einstein once noted, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle, and the other is as if everything is. So I think that intuitive ways of thinking, and the creativity that's affiliated with diffuse kinds of thinking sometimes seems beyond human understanding, and that's part of the beauty of mathematics.
There's a great example of thinking processes in here. To come back to the focused and diffuse thinking, where the focused is you're sitting there, you're making sure you get on this. The diffuse, you can get away from it for a while and let other neural networks in your brain begin to help you figure out a situation, which I find a lot. Walk away from it. If it's really bedeviling you, walk away from it. Come back, and all of a sudden, oh, it makes sense in a different context now. And it could be because of something you saw while you were busy out walking away from it. But there's a great example in here of activating these thinking types, and it's a sentence that simply contains, this sentence contains three errors. And the word this is spelled with two S's, and the word three is spelled with three E's, so there's two errors. And then you're sitting there thinking, what is the third error? And I began to suspect and flip to the back, and sure enough.
Yeah, the third error, shall we tell listeners what?
Yes, let's give it away.
The third error is, paradoxically enough, that there's no error. And so that's an error because there's no error, which means that it kind of takes you in this sort of repeating curve endlessly back to error and no error. And I just love that. And actually, paradox is one theme of the book, which is that whatever you think is important in helping you learn, that's also important in stopping you from learning. And we found that just now with when we were talking about the diffuse and the focused modes, the focused you sit in and you can actually focus and concentrate on things, but that blocks your thinking to the different neural networks you sometimes need in order to solve the problem. And so, paradoxically enough, the one thing that you're doing to try and solve the problem is what you have to stop doing in order to actually solve the problem.
So don't turn off the poet, don't turn off the dancer, just to keep the math person in you active. The fact is those other two people can help.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's the same way, too, for things like working with others. Working with others can be so incredibly helpful in helping you to learn. It helps sort of sharpen your way of thinking about things. It helps bring out and help you understand when you're not learning something, when you haven't figured something out, even though you have thought you've done that. But at the same time, a lot of times focused attention by yourself is the best way to at least initially start getting those ideas in mind.
I want to come back to the issue of chunking that you brought up before. This is about ways of taking in information in chunks, and this is as simple at its root as the way we report phone numbers in groups of threes and fours, right?
Absolutely. Chunking, we used to think that, well, here's the important insight about chunking. That a chunk is like one little neural net in your brain. And it relates to, like, let's say you know that 2 times 2 is 4. So that's like one chunk in your brain. You've got that. And then when you start learning an area and you gain expertise, oftentimes you have to get all these chunks. So if you're learning chess, you're learning all sorts of different strategies, and these different strategies and board layouts are chunks in your mind. And the more you get in your mind and the quicker you're able to access them, the better your expertise becomes. And so chunking, as it turns out, acquiring these different little constellations of neurons that are connected together in your brain is a super important part of learning. And so that's one thing that really helped me when I language. I would practice sentences so they'd go out really smoothly. And later, I began practicing with equations so I could pull them to mind smoothly. And I later learned that's exactly what I should have been doing, turning them into smooth chunks that I could easily grab and pull to mind and work with.
Let's take another call. Here's Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Barbara Oakley, the author of A Mind for Numbers.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Oakley. I think you said Oakland University. I actually took a class there a long time ago. But as someone who has had great challenges with math my whole life, I have a question for you. But first, I want to follow up on the earlier caller who mentioned something about cognitive dissonance. Well, I've worked with a lot of kids of various ages, almost all of whom have had real problems with learning in school. And my observation is that the source of the problem is not the lack of their cognitive capacities, but that they have emotional difficulties. They have learned, and this was certainly true for me, as a source, I have been tested on both the SAT and the ACTs years ago. And in both cases, I came up in the high 90s on everything but math. And math, I think I actually might have set a record with a low score of like 19.
Wow.
And I've always found a way to work around it. One point in my life, I was actually running a department in the hospital that had $500,000 a year budget, and I was so grateful that my administrator had no idea that I'd only managed to balance a checkbook once in my life, and it had been so traumatic for me that I never did it again. But I had a secretary who was great at math, so she did all the budgetary stuff while I did all the clinical stuff, and we worked out a deal on that. But that's, I don't think my story is that unusual. I think when people form an emotional block, get the idea maybe that they're really stupid about something, that it's not so much about the cognitive abilities, but about, you know, the kids I've read, I've worked with who have had great difficulty reading, it's like at a certain point they give up on the whole project. And then they become emotionally committed to the idea that who needs reading? It's mm-hmm. stupid. I don't need to do it. And they'll never learn unless they change that idea. So my question is, does your book address this level of learning difficulty?
All right, let's take it from there. Thanks for the call, Sandy. Appreciate it. Barbara?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you for that, Sandy. I think it's always difficult to learn anything if you are trying to grapple with it under situations where you're scared or you're frightened or there's deep emotions involved. For math, this often has a particular impact because math is very sequential. So if you fall off at any step along the way, it's very difficult to get back on the wagon. So I think a lot of people have this problem with math more so than in language, because language is a little bit more holistic. You lose a patch. Let's say you had a bad first half of fifth grade, and you don't pick up some of the language skills at that point, you can still sort of patch it in and make up for it because it's not so sequential, it's more holistic. But with math, you lose the first half of fifth grade, and you're really in difficulties. So my book is more addressed towards, it's meant to help people who are trying to reconfigure how they're looking at learning. And part of that often involves the idea of taking a step back and looking at what you want to try to do and then taking it slowly. Don't try and think that you can rewire your brain in a day, just like don't try and think that you could pick up a new language in a day. So, in fact, learning language is a lot like learning learning math is a lot like learning language. So it needs time. It needs just a little bit each day and sort of being patient with yourself. And I think no matter what your background, whether you fell off the math bandwagon at third grade, eighth grade, or wherever, if you're willing to stop and kind of start slowly, be patient with yourself, it's absolutely mind-boggling how far you can go.
Let's talk to Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Barbara Oakley. A Mind for Numbers is her book.
Yeah, very quickly. I'm 73 years old. First grade, I got so sick and tired of 2 and 2 is 4, I guess I yelled out, well, 4 what? Why do we need 4? And I don't think it's just guys that need a visual whatever. Sophomore high school, tried to do algebra, no way, couldn't have it, change classes. And then I realized basically that's what I had been doing since I was a kid and still do. I buy something that's used, and with the help of other people, we fix it up and resell it. It was bicycles and motorcycles, cars, real estate, whatever. You just instinctively understand the 4 strong links of the chain: cost, price, worth, and value. And one of the big problems is we have too many people, from presidents of the United States to people in the classrooms, who don't, well, as many of us say, can't enjoyably, for each party, negotiate their way out of a wet paper bag.
All right. Thanks for the perspective, Jim.
Well, I think that relates to the idea of experts themselves. And interestingly, research has shown that sometimes experts are not as good at actually doing whatever problem solving needs to be done. And the example of that is they took paramedics, and they had paramedics, real paramedics, and then they had people who taught paramedics. and then they presented them with a real-life situation. And the experts who taught paramedics, they judged how people acted more on whether they kind of followed these pedantic little manifestations of skill.
Follow the procedures.
As opposed to whether they really knew what they were doing. And so the experts couldn't tell the people who had real expertise and were doing it properly because they were judging on sort of these artificial constraints. So I do think sometimes the experts know that they can be so involved in little rules that they forget the fact that a real expert often incorporates these rules and can use them so swiftly and so well that it seems almost like magic. So I think that's a little related to that issue.
Well, I certainly don't want to scare anybody away. Our time is up here, but the book A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra, is not a math book. It's really a brain book about how your brain works and getting that in order to make sure that you can approach the work that you may decide lies ahead of you, as did Barbara Oakley. Barbara, thanks for doing that, and thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
It's been a pleasure. And that'll do it for today's program. You can find more about our subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You can also find us on Facebook and at Jeff Exchange on Twitter. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the proposed expansion of the footprint of the Oregon Caves National Monument. In our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about the sick leave situation and the handling of it at various local government levels in Eugene. And we'll also talk about GMO labeling and whether this is something Congress should take up. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the retiring boss at Southern Oregon Goodwill, leaving after 37 years. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow at 8 on another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. Have a great day.